going to do Kaluza-Klein theory, and I'm looking here and realizing I don't have the rest of some notes. So what are the handout, the things that are on the, you know, if you don't have it, they're just on the side. Actually, I call Kaluza-Klein. It's not really. I'm going to talk just generally about extra dimensions. But mostly focus on Kaluza-Klein. So, I mean, extra dimensions, it's quite, you know, by the time we get to the sort of closing stages of the course, it's always, I don't know, I'm always in a dilemma of which topics to cover. And there's this sort of competition between the way gravity is used in very, you know, forgetting about quantum gravity, the way gravity is used in the more formal end of things like string theory versus sort of really genuine hands-on experimental gravity, you know, what people are doing in terms of observing gravitational waves, imaging event horizons, and also actually testing gravity in the lab via analogs. Sam Patrick in the back there sort of asked me if he could give a lecture. We talked with Mighty. She thought maybe, you know, it would be just a short lecture series, but then apparently you had quite a few of those. So instead, you're going to get a taster on analog gravity next Wednesday. So that's just, you know, a very different experimental area. So it's just sort of seeing different ways in which we sort of look at gravity. In that case, it's not so much, I would say, testing gravity directly. It's sort of testing this interaction of the quantum with the classical. So here we're going to look at more the formal end of things by looking at extra dimensions. So I should say there is zero evidence, right, for extra dimensions currently. But it's one of those things that's just, you know, as a theorist, you just can't help yourself, right? You look at gravity, you look at it's in four dimensions, and you think, why four, okay? So if you're more mathematical, you'll give the glib answer, because otherwise your shoelaces would come undone in higher dimensions. It's to do with knot theory. Or you could think, well, four is like, this is sort of Occam's razor. It is the lowest dimension in which gravity gets interesting, because it's the lowest dimension in which you have propagating gravity. So not just gravitational waves, but you have local Riemann curvature, local tidal forces. So it's, you know, so that could be another reason. Well, it's four because it's simplest. However, for essentially all of my research lifetime, so to speak, we've just been very much alive to the possibility of extra dimensions, mainly because we want to try to unify gravity with quantum field theory. And we kind of try to do it without giving up, as a rule at least, without giving up that some of, you know, the features of each in some sense. So extra dimensions arise not just because they're there, but because if you try to make a supersymmetric theory of gravity, if you go via the root of string theory, then you are led either to sort of 10 or 11 dimensions, sort of depending on how much you probe, so to speak. So it's really something that you kind of need to be aware of. What does gravity look like in higher dimensions? And also, how do we explain the fact that we only see four dimensions? Because that is true, right? We only see four dimensions. And so really what's interesting about extra dimensions is that the concept is almost as old as GR. So there's this famous story of, get my Kaluzas and Klein straight. So it was Kaluza who originally suggested an extra dimension. And that was back, I think, in 1919. he wrote a you know, wrote it up, sent it to Einstein, who just, you know, said, oh, no, 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 can't possibly be. But then, you know, as time goes on, this is sort of when you get a new idea that you're just not sure of, you often resist it at first. But then eventually Kaluza went and published, and the paper was published in 1921, because Einstein eventually sort of accepted that there might be something in it. And so the idea, so this is Kaluza. And the idea was unifying. It was again this notion of unifying gravity and electromagnetism. So that was the motivation. And then Klein in 1926-ish. Essentially gave more of a quantum interpretation. And introduced this idea of compactification. So in other words, it was, Kaluza had sort of this original idea, hey, 5D gravity is like 4D gravity plus electromagnetism. But then Klein came up with this idea of what we now would call compactification, which is simply that your extra dimension is so small that essentially you don't see it on everyday scales. And so the argument there would be that if this is some length L, then your sort of ds squared is some ds4 squared, say, I'm just doing this schematically here, minus a d chi squared, where delta chi is L. Then if you write a wave function, you Fourier decompose because it's periodically identified. Sorry, 2 pi on L. Then the way you're, if this was a massless scalar, grad squared psi would equal the four-dimensional D'Alembertian on psi naught, you'd pull out this phase, and you would also then have a term coming from the derivative of the phase. Now, as I said, you could think of this as a Fourier mode, so you could add in an n in front of the chi, in which case you'd have an n squared here. But now what you see, this looks like a massive particle with a mass that goes like 2 pi n on L. So if L is very small, you have a very large mass for your scalar. And then the argument goes that if you're just at low energies relative to that mass, all you will see are massless. The low energy theory would be that of a massless scalar. So in essence, your scalar would be independent of that extra dimension. And so you'd just be having a four-dimensional theory. So that was the sort of, that's just a sort of loose argument. But the idea of Kaluza-Klein is that essentially, let me just put it in brackets, nothing and I say nothing, what this really means is geometrically d by d chi is a killing vector. So geometrically, if nothing depends on your extra dimension, then everything that's happening is just happening in the remaining four dimensions. There is also, which we've kind of seen, There's also this, so Kaluza and Klein was basically the way of taking extra dimensions for about 80 years, roughly. But then round about the turn of the millennium, we realized that, in fact, there's a different way of effectively compactifying, which is having large extra dimensions, but warped. And here, you have, again, I'm just going to contrast it. It's not quite true, but essentially everything depends on chi. I'm just doing that to contrast with Kaluza-Klein. But what it's really saying is that you have very strong dependence. So we're localized on a submanifold, and that's really harking back to the last lecture of a domain wall. So this would be where particle physics is restricted to some codimension one submanifold, or codimension n submanifold, and there are ways of sort of plausibly arguing how that happens, which we don't really have time to go into. And then you have a very strong dependence of the geometry on the orthogonal direction, which effectively localizes gravity. So this is called a brain world. So if you wanted to read into it, you already have the tools to understand that particular branch of the literature, because not only have we done all the mechanics of curvature, etc., but we have talked about domain walls. So you've got this concept of, you know, in the domain wall, we had that orthogonal function, which was peaked around the domain wall. And so that's kind of the ingredient for a warped compactification. So I'm going to now go to focus on Kaluza-Klein theory, because it gives you a sort of quite nice insight or view into how you can look at doing extra dimensions. And also some of the, not the details of the calculation, but perhaps some of the ways you approach things can also be used even when you have a warp compactification. And in reality, most of the, like the Calabi-Yau type of compactifications people look at have a little bit of ingredient from each of Kaluza-Klein and warped.
So I have a quick question. So if we're looking at it this way, with the warped compactification, would that mean we live on the, like, submanifold?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is, say, four dimensions, right? 4D. And all of the wave functions of standard model particles are localized strongly on that submanifold. So then you have to ask, how do they get confined? And that's sort of, you know, that goes into the particle physics of it. It's quite easy actually to confine scalars, because, you know, you just have to couple them to some field that's defining the vacuum that gives them a mass out away from the brain but makes them massless inside the brain. It's sort of a bit like superconductivity.
Your shoes wouldn't come untied on a submanifold.
We wouldn't.
Your shoes wouldn't come untied.
No, the shoes would definitely not come untied on the submanifold. No, that's for sure. Because they're made of string. They were made of theoretical geodesics, they might, because those can go. So, I just want to distinguish G5 from G4 here. So we have this picture in Kaluza-Klein theory. Now, I realize, you know, this sort of separation here, this was just sort of showing quickly, you know, the original sort of concept with Klein. But here we have, we break down our metric. Actually, I should mean GAB. So we ask, if we have a five-dimensional metric, let's just completely starting from scratch, we have, as usual with a symmetric matrix, it's n into n plus 1 on 2, so that's 5 times 3, that's 15 metric components. And what we're doing is we're just boxing them off. So here are the four metric components, 10. I'm sure I'm going to, here are another 4. And here is 1, because this is related by symmetry. So I'm splitting up the number of functions in G5AB. So this is not thinking about gauge yet. This is just saying, how many components do we have? How do we package them? So now we package them. And actually, let me do what I did originally, the G tilde.
Excuse me.
So we package, yeah.
G mu 5 and G mu 5, aren't they like symmetric? So
yeah.
G nu 5 be 5 mu?
Yeah, but it's all, I mean, it's the same thing, you know, in the sense of the five-dimensional metric is also symmetric. I mean, yes, if you want to be, you know, do that, by, but I mean, it's the same thing, right? It's just, it has four components.
Yeah, but instead of mu, shouldn't be mu, 5 mu? Is that mu or mu?
Where?
You know, it's just like G mu 5 and...
Yeah, well, okay, I'm going to... picking me up on a... 5 nu, that's it. What's wrong?
Mu or mu?
What?
Should be saying
it's symmetric. Uh-huh. But if I count the... If I look at... I mean, I'm just counting these. I'm just following the indices, to be honest. Yeah, because, you know, if I took the B to be... it lying in the four-dimensional space, if I took A as 5 and B is some, you know, it would have to be new because it's the second index here. If you want to be really picky, right, it really does have to be new. It's fine. You can be picky, but it's fine. But, I mean, if you think about the ordering of the indices here, which, you know, you're right to pull me up on it because really it should be this, yeah, but... You know, A has, you know, if these are both four-dimensional indices, it refers to a particular component here. If A is a four-dimensional index and B is 5, it goes along the top. If B is a four-dimensional index and A is 5, that's taking you down the first column, right? So strictly speaking, this is correct, yeah, in terms of the labeling. However, this is how we package it, right? So in fact, this G naught is not that G tilde, because G tilde is G naught plus 2 copies of A. Okay. So actually, squared. Thank you. It's going to be one of those mornings, isn't it? That's now right. Okay. So we've basically just packaged our metric slightly differently to this. This was just looking at the components of a symmetric 5x5 matrix. Now we're thinking, how am I going to package these and deal with them from the space-time perspective? So we kind of complete a square between the fifth direction, the chi, and the other four dimensions. So we're kind of wrapping these cross terms into this now more complex one form. So our fields are sigma, a mu, and g naught mu nu. So you might think, well, why is that so very different? But because of the way that we package them, well, obviously sigma is just a scalar. A is clearly a vector, but this also turns out to be a tensor from the 4D perspective. So we've decomposed our five-dimensional metric, which is a five-dimensional spin 2 field, into three fields in four dimensions, which have spin 0, spin 1, and spin 2. Now, you actually do this same thing when you do cosmological perturbation theory. And it can sometimes be just a little confusing because people talk about, you know, the tensor perturbations with the microwave background. And you think, well, hang on, all gravity perturbations are tensor, right? But what they're actually talking about is the, if you like, what representation of the lower dimensional Lorentz group do these fields lie in? And this way of decomposing the metric means that this really does behave like a spin one field in four dimensions. And what's left here behaves like your sort of four-dimensional graviton. Okay?
So can you explain again why you wrote the metric like that to e to the to sigma?
So, well, I mean, e to the, this specific one is a choice. I could write it any way, but the point is it's a scalar field. But that one is just a scalar. It's sort of telling you how the extra dimension shifts, scales in size as you move around the manifold. But this one, the fact that I've peeled off this same, this is where it starts to become, you know, at least a priori, there's no reason why you would, right? But here it will turn out that because I've done that splitting, this behaves like essentially electromagnetism in four dimensions. And this behaves like gravity in four dimensions. Now, there's a couple of caveats with that which are covered in that handout, in the sense that what the handout does is it takes you from this metric to the curvature and therefore tells you how the Einstein action changes. So to compute curvature, see the handout is what I'm going to say. I think what's useful about that particular calculation is you see the Cartan formalism in action when you start to get more complex forms in your orthonormal basis. So, but the net headline that I want to pick up on is that my five-dimensional Einstein action becomes a four-dimensional, almost Einstein action. So there are a few things that I just want to highlight about this. So what we've done here is we've used that computation to find R5 in terms of R4, and we pick up F squared pieces and derivatives of the scalar. The F squared pieces are really what justifies peeling off the cross terms in this way, because that F is the Maxwell stress tensor. So this is where you see that you have the spin one vector field. Also, what I want to draw your attention to is this combination here, which is G5 on L. So we've reduced things to four dimensions. We're not quite at Einstein gravity. So let me just note that we have e to the sigma R4, not R4. And really what you do with this very much depends on your level of comfort, whether you like, whether you're, if you're comfortable with geometry, you don't care that there's a scalar there. If you prefer to have your gravity looking canonical, but you're happy to have a complicated matter Lagrangian, then what you do is you do a conformal transformation and you set G hat mu nu, or let me leave it as G hat, is omega squared G naught mu nu, which you're going to say, if this is your conformal transformation, you're just rescaling the metric, you're not changing angles, and your curvature in four dimensions transforms. So you set omega is e to the minus sigma on 2, and redefine sigma. You asked me why it was sigma. I mean, I could have put this. Redefine it as a new field, which again, this is in the handout, but I just wanted to draw attention to it. And I'll tell you about what Gn is in a minute. Actually, let me put that minus sign inside. Okay. So this now gives you sort of Einstein. This is sort of a canonically normalized scalar. And here you have electromagnetism, but it's coupled to the scalar. So it's almost exactly Einstein-Maxwell, but with this scalar degree of freedom. And finally, this was the other thing to note, Gn is G5 on L. And this is, if I've called it Gn, because this is the four-dimensional Newton constant. So in this, what you sort of see are the seeds of large extra dimensions, because if L were very big, relative to the Planck scale, then that would give you a sort of hierarchy between the Planck scales in five dimensions and four dimensions. And so this is kind of attractive as a means of, if you like, lowering the effective Planck scale so that we don't have this sort of problem of, you know, having this desert, if you like, between the standard model scale and the Planck scale, and sort of trying to sort of keep tuning all of our coupling constants. So
excuse me, how did we get that equation gn is equal to g5 over L again?
The red, this red thing up here. We know that our Einstein action is minus 1 over 16 pi g integral of r. So we know that if we look at that and we want to identify our four-dimensional theory, we have to have this being the Newton constant, because the Einstein-Hilbert action is our constant in front of it is derived by looking at the Newton's gravitational equation. So we need the right Newtonian limit. So this is forced on us by the action. But then how we choose to interpret it or play with it is another matter.
And L comes from the integration.
Integration over chi.
It's the scale of the fifth dimension?
It's the scale of this internal dimension, yeah. So, I mean, obviously, it's not going to do much if we've got one extra dimension. But if you start having several extra dimensions, then each of them, you know, roughly speaking, if I just put this as an aside, say gn is, you know, going to go like g to the, let's say, 4 plus little d, and that goes over by L to the, you know, L to the d. So the more extra dimensions you've got, the bigger you can make this hierarchy. But then, even if from a geometric perspective, so at the moment we sort of have tested gravity down to, it's certainly the millimeter scale, let's say. So let's say we've got something, it's not hard, I think, once d gets to, when d gets to 6, it's very easy to take you from just roundabout standard model scale to our four-dimensional Newtonian scale. The problem is that things like, you know, extra dimensions on the scale of nanometers, right? That's fine for our geometry, but it's a real problem if you've got a pure Kaluza-Klein theory, because that's very sort of low energy from a particle physics perspective. And so that's why you end up with this brain world interpretation, because your standard model particles need to be localized on a much smaller scale than you might sort of think, you know, then gravity forces you, right?
I don't know that much, but I heard that like Nima Arkani-Hallman has like an idea of like getting like a very large compactification to those small ones. Then it would kind of like solve this, or is still that's very.
So those, yeah, I mean, that's one of the large extra dimension scenarios, yeah. But whenever you have enough volume in your extra dimensions to give you the hierarchy, that is too much space for standard model particles not to be localized. Okay, so I think, yeah, that's grammatically correct. so you find that yes, you can make it a nice hierarchy, but then you have to have a mechanism for having things confined to the brain. So that's sort of the, you know, and then you also have to think about the geometry and the extra dimensions. You know, most of the models kind of, you know, gravity doesn't really behave like gravity in the real world, you know, where everything gravitates. Often things are sort of, you know, spread out, smeared over the extra dimension, which, you know, again, that's something that you have to sort of look into and justify. So I think there's quite a lot of large extra dimension scenarios, but I think what the take-home message I would say from all of that research is that we don't need to do pure Kaluza-Klein theory if we have extra dimensions. And if we don't try to solve the hierarchy problem with large extra dimensions, then we can have some really interesting compactifications where the sort of net effect is a little bit of a mix between Kaluza-Klein ideas and having some sort of long warped throats. So you get these Calabi-Yaus, which have this sort of long sort of warped throat, which can give some interesting phenomenology.
Sure. I've got a question about, so like how people choose, you know, how to decide, you know, when you, like how many warp compactifications versus these sort of compactifications. Mm. What are they trying to match it to? Are they trying to match it to the standard model, or are they?
Depends who you talk to, doesn't it? I mean, so the original large extra dimensions very much came from phenomenology. So it came from phenomenologists trying to sort of find an innovative way to deal with the hierarchy problem. But then that then translated over into string theory, and string theory is looking at more interesting compactifications. So originally, you know, if you go back sort of 30 years, you'll see that all of the compactifications on Calabi-Yazor are all Kaluza-Kleinian style. But then sort of 10 to 15 years later, it starts to change. And in particular, I've got to remember the KKLT, so Katru, Kalosh, Linde, Trivedi, you know, these guys used some of these concepts of both warp compactifications having sort of brains wrapped on various cycles in the manifold to try and get. So one of the problems with string theory is it doesn't really like de Sitter space. It prefers anti de Sitter, whereas our cosmology is definitely lambda dominated. And so it's always been a little bit of an issue how you get a positive lambda or effective positive lambda universe in a theory that prefers negative lambda. And so in the end, most of the sort of good ideas sort of do have these brainy sorts of ingredients in them. So, but they also have the Kaluza-Klein. Let me just plow on a little bit, and then we can go down the rabbit hole again a bit. Because it's all interesting stuff. So let me just say what the metric looks like. So this is our metric, but what I want to note is that compactification picks a frame. So what do I mean by that? So let's look at what we mean by compactification. This is Klein. So this is our, let's take our T and chi. Let's focus on T and chi. And this is a light ray. Now, if I do a Lorentz boost, my new axes here are T prime and chi prime. So here, if I'm compactifying, this is L, you usually say compactify by identifying chi with chi plus L. That's what you do when you compactify. So you'd normally just write that, but what you're actually meaning at constant T. So that's what you don't always write. So here, if I look at this picture, I identify this with this and I get a little cylinder. But then if I thought about what does that mean with respect to my inertial frame that's Lorentz transformed, well, T prime is gamma T minus Vx, X chi primed is gamma chi minus Vt, or T primed is, so the identification, so if I just go back to my sketch, this point here, which is at T primed equals zero, is actually identified to that point there, which is not T primed equals zero. So I'm now doing a double identification, if you like, in the Lorentz transformed frame. So once I've picked my compactification frame, and I say I compactify my extra dimension at this length scale at constant t, that's essentially picked my frame. Because if I go to any other inertial frame, then I'm going to have to start, you know, identifying at different times and stuff. Why is that relevant? Well, you could look at that metric at the top there and say, well, why can't I gauge away my A? All I do is just redefine my chi. I just get rid of the A. I don't have cross terms. So why did I put it there in the first place? Well, the reason is if you try and get rid of it, you destroy that. You change what you mean by your compactification. Your compactification is picked a rest frame. So if we just see what that does, so we talked about briefly about the black string, which was Schwarzschild times R. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do that Lorentz transformation. So my dt, I'm going to say, is a dt primed, or rather it goes to dt plus v dz. So before I identify, so first of all, I make an infinite black string, but before I identify my extra dimension, I do a Lorentz boost. So I Lorentz boost and then I identify. So if I now pick up what my GZZ is, which is this e to the 2 root 3 phi, that is 1 over 1 minus v squared, 1 minus v squared into 1 minus 2gm on r. So I've just picked up the 1 from here and the v squared from here. But you see the first term is 1 minus v squared, so that gives me a 1. And then the second term is 2gm over 2gm v squared over 1 minus v squared. Oh.
So what is the physical interpretation of black string? So I have a black hole and then in an extra dimension, I'm just like...
Just translate it. Yeah. So it just looks like a horizon that's cylindrical, translated in the z direction. So having identified GZZ, I complete the square, which means I'm identifying what that A mu is. So my, actually, I can see that my A mu is just going to have a T component because the cross terms are just V dt dz. Okay, so the idea there is you're simply, you want to get the dt dz terms arising from the square of that dz plus a dt. So this is what the metric looks like. You then have to tidy up the GTT piece, because that bit here is the original GTT minus the a squared term. And now if you look at this, there's a few things that kind of suggest themselves to you, so to speak. Well, the first is that you should redefine what you mean by a radial coordinate, because it would be nicer if things would just look like some sort of M over R. So I kind of know that out at infinity, I need the same radial coordinate. So the easiest way of achieving that is to just re-zero the radial coordinate. And then that tells me I have to redefine a mass, which is actually kind of nice that it goes like gamma m, because, you know, we Lorentz boosted in order to get this metric in the first place. Then I'm going to define a q, which is also related to m. So I now have my gauge field as being the potential for a point charge q. So this looks like electric charge. So if I were to write it from my four-dimensional perspective, saying, what are my 4D fields? I would say my scalar field was given by one minus VQ on R. So that gives me my scalar potential. I've given you the vector potential. And then the remaining bit, which is the four-dimensional metric, plus a half. So this is what my four-dimensional metric is. So notice that GTT and GRR are the inverse of each other. So that's kind of like Schwarzschild, even if they're more complicated. But now R is not the aerial coordinate, not the area of two spheres. So this is an electric Kalitzer-Klein black hole. So you see how it's different. I mean, I guess you've done Riesen and Nordström in tutorials or whatever. So this doesn't really look anything like it. And the reason it doesn't, I'm so sorry, that's not e to the minus 2 root 3. The reason it doesn't is because of that scalar field there. Okay, so that was the electric black hole. But I did want to talk about this because it's kind of cute. So in four dimensions, we also have a point particle that is magnetically charged. So our electromagnetism has a duality symmetry under the exchange of F with its dual. So our electric charge, the dual of that becomes Q sine theta d theta wedge d phi, where that phi is now the azimuthal angle. And Dirac was actually the first to think about magnetic monopoles back in the 1930s. Ah, what a spacer. And he thought, well, can we have a magnetically charged hole, monopole? So DF is zero, which it needs to be, because that's one of the, or half of the Maxwell equations. But is F equal to dA, right? So that's where the interesting part comes in. So if I want to integrate this up, I can sort of say, well, look, that's obvious. It's just minus Q d of cos theta. So it's d of cos theta d phi, right? But if I look at that as a form, that is singular on the axes. So this is more or less following some of Dirac's reasoning. So how about I just add an integration constant? So I change this to A is Q into 1 minus cos theta d phi. So this one is now regular on the North Pole, but it's still singular on the South Pole. But AS is minus Q into 1 plus cos theta d phi is regular on the South Pole. Now, Dirac was only looking at electromagnetism, and so he kind of came up with this notion that I can make it regular everywhere except along half an infinite line, and then I can move that around depending on what I choose for my gauge transformation. Here, we don't have electromagnetism, we just have geometry. And what I'm describing to you here, my A here and our A mu is just giving us some components of the metric. So we can do a gauge transformation. So notice A south is A north minus 2q d phi. So I could redefine my phi coordinate to adjust between A north and A south. So from a as long as I just change what I mean by that psi angle, which was, I guess, Z before, sorry about that. I'm using psi because I'm now thinking of it as an angle. That is really just a coordinate transformation. So our Kaluza-Klein solution, and then I'll talk about the gauge transformation, is ds squared is r minus r plus over r minus r minus dt squared minus dr squared over 1 minus r plus on r. So this is if we just were integrating up the vacuum solution. This would be, R plus would be like an integration constant or related to an integration constant that would be related to M. And R minus is really sort of where the charge comes in. These are our two coordinate patches, which cover, if I sketch my sort of XYZ plane, I cover the northern hemisphere with the north patch and the southern hemisphere with the southern patch. So psi n is on theta is in naught, pi on 2 plus epsilon, and psi s, my other patch, is theta is pi on 2 minus epsilon and pi. But for this coordinate transformation, to be well defined, I have to, if I go from phi goes to phi plus 2 pi, I'd better also be at the same point in psi. So in other words, my psi south, which is psi north plus 2q phi, had better be equal to psi north plus 2q phi plus 2 pi. So that tells me that my delta psi, north or south, has to equal 4 pi q over n, where n is an integer. So in other words, the charge is quantized. Now here, I've sort of said the charge is of the monopole solution is quantized. Dirac turned that around and said, sort of looked at wave functions propagating on the background, and said that if you had, because you already know the electric charge, then you know your magnetic charge can only be sort of take discrete values. Or correspondingly, if you have a single magnetic monopole anywhere in the universe, electric charge has to be quantized. So that was his, you know, really, I think, quite sort of revolutionary, if you like, insight is the existence of a single magnetic monopole implies that electric charge is quantized. And then I just wanted to note something about the extremal limit, which is R plus is R minus. My metric and I'm just doing a single charge here. Can sort of be split up into something very nice. It's just a time direction crossed with a four-dimensional Euclidean manifold. And this here, we can sort of redefine coordinates so that this looks like an S3. Coordinatized with Euler angles. And so what you get, and I'm really out of time, what you actually get is what's known as a hop vibration of S1 over S2. So here is your S2. this psi was an S1. Remember, we were adding a periodic direction. But you're not just fibering your S2 with like chain mail, you know, sort of little set of chain mail going all around the S2, where you fix the same point in your chain mail, if you like, where the circle closes to the sphere, which would just be an S2 cross S1 topology. Each time you go around on an angle of constant latitude, as you glue your S1 onto the sphere, you're just giving it a little twist, so that by the time you've gone all the way round, you've twisted by a full 2 pi. And so what that does is actually lifts the S2 into an S3. So it's just one of these sort of cute little pieces of mathematics. And this is known as the Kaluza-Klein monopole. And it's just a fun solution. Better stop there. Worry about the break in the middle. So that's called, this is this hop vibration. I haven't really gone into it. You kind of, in this extremal limit, what you do, you want to finish the argument. So this is now an extra time here. Let's see. So you redefine rho squared is 4q into r minus q. And that should... yeah, that will turn this into a d rho squared piece. We did that with the Euclidean black hole metric. And then we get our metric being d rho squared, and the angular part turns into rho squared on 4 d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared plus d chi plus 1 minus cos theta d phi, all squared, and chi is equal to psi on q, so that the periodicity of chi is 4 pi. And this is the metric on a 3-sphere in Euler angles, okay? And you see it by doing x plus i y, z plus i w is rho cos theta on 2 e to the I chi on 2, and that's rho sine theta on 2 e to the I phi plus chi on 2. So this is where I've gone into the North Pole patch. And then if you look at the equation for just a pure 3-sphere in flat space, x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus w squared is 1, you'll get that metric. So this just looks like the origin of R4. And so, actually, the Kaluza-Klein monopole is topologically R5. It's just one of these funny metrics, yeah?
Over there, when you mentioned that we were changing A, and you said from a KK perspective, we will get a different, d psi. I didn't get that how changing A will actually change the... Because your dz, psi was z, right?
Yeah, so psi is... I mean, here, this is A, right?
Yeah.
This is A north. This is A south. So my A south is A north minus Q, 2Q d phi. If you look at the definition of A north and A south, the difference between them is just 2Q d phi. And then when I put that into the metric, so this is my d psi plus A north, this is d psi plus A south.
But the point I'm trying to make that the psi was our fifth dimension or chi that we have. Mm-hmm. I know you had d chi plus a mu dx mu. So this is like terms. How come they're mixed together now? We have terms that d chi plus d phi squared.
That is just a coordinate choice originally, that d chi plus a d dx. Yeah, that's just a set of coordinates. I can change. Sorry, no, come in, Lucien. That's fine. I can change coordinates. You know, this is just a particular gauge. There's nothing fixed about chi, I'm free to change my coordinates. And so I start off with my metric written, let's say, with this. I put in the north, and so I've just added that subscript n there. And then I say, well, how would I get to the south pole A? well, I have to change what I mean by chi. And I'm only shifting it by, well, what I'm doing is I'm actually sort of just shifting it with by mixing it a little bit with phi. And that's not a problem. Sorry, that's a coordinate transformation, but phi is, and the reason it works is because phi is periodic, right, as well. But then what it means is the two periodicities have to be consistent. And that's where the quantization of charge comes from. Now, I better stop. You've got